Thank you, Sue, and good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is Thursday, January 19th, 2023. I am Judge Louise Devery-Bjorkman, and I'm joined on the panel this morning by Judges Michelle Larkin and Jennifer Frisch. This is the second matter on our calendar for oral argument this morning. It is the matter of the welfare of DLN. You will each have 15 minutes to present your arguments. Mr. Pushka, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal should you choose to use it. It's important that you state your name and identify the party that you are representing because we are making an audio recording of this proceeding. And in fact, that is the only permissible recording of this proceeding. With that, Mr. Pushka, I hope I'm pronouncing your name, Pushka, correctly. I'm sure you will correct me. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, opposing counsel, my name is Attorney Drew Hushkin. I'm representing the appellant child in this appeal. This appeal concerns a fairly simple question, a straightforward question of whether the district court erred in admitting prior bad act evidence when the state did not identify a proper purpose for the evidence, failed to explain how the evidence was material and relevant to its case, and failed to use the bad act evidence for any permissible purpose at trial. Appellant respectfully requests that this court answer that question in the affirmative and reverse and remand for a new trial. Now, before I get to the legal standard and the applicable case law, I want to discuss a summary of the pertinent facts because the admission of bad act evidence is a highly fact-dependent inquiry. Specifically below, appellant was charged with two counts of first-degree criminal sexual conduct and two counts of second-degree criminal sexual conduct for allegations that he digitally penetrated his minor cousin and caused her to manipulate his genitalia. Now, more than 5 months after the parties had a contested omnibus hearing, for the first time, the state identified that it sought to offer that prior bad act evidence, serving its Spriegel notice. Through its Spriegel notice, the state identified that it sought to offer evidence that appellant had previously massaged GIS's buttocks while the two of them were playing house, that he had digitally penetrated her while she was asleep in a hotel room, and also wanted to offer evidence that he had placed his hands in another cousin BF's shorts while the two of them were in a closet playing hide and seek. The state's boilerplate Spriegel notice advised that, quote, I hereby advise you that in the above named case, the prosecution may offer at trial under the expectation to the general exclusionary rule for the purpose of motive, opportunity, intent, preparation, plan, knowledge, identity, or absence of mistake or accident, end quote, the foregoing evidence. Appellant objected to this Spriegel notice. In response, the state argued the prior act evidence showed, quote, a propensity toward inappropriate sexual conduct with young girls and was admissible to prove a common scheme or plan, end quote. Following a hearing on the issue, the district court decided to let the bad act evidence in. Then following trial, the state repeatedly elicited that Spriegel evidence. The state elicited the allegations regarding the massage in the hotel from GIS herself, discussing each in detail. The state then had a family friend of GIS, the detective and the friend and a forensic interviewer all discussed the massage and hotel allegations. Lastly, the state called BF for the sole purpose of introducing evidence of the hide and seek allegation. That was the only testimony she provided. She identified herself and then provided testimony regarding the hide and seek allegation. Following the admission of the evidence, the jury found appellant guilty on all four counts, and appellant appealed the case to this court. My apologies. As previously outlined, we argue that the district court erred in admitting this Spriegel evidence. This court reviews that admission of Spriegel evidence under the abuse of discretion standard, with a defendant needing to show an error and resulting prejudice from that error. Appellant respectfully averes the district court erred in admitting the Spriegel evidence and that its erroneous admission prejudiced him. Now, the standard
below... What's your strongest argument within your argument that the Spriegel evidence was inadmissible for several reasons? What's your strongest argument?
You know, I think the strongest or the most clear cut is the errors in the state's notice in this case. It's clear cut. It's a boilerplate notice that it doesn't actually identify any of the purposes for which the state wants to introduce it. I understand it's untimely, but that's not a winning ground as prior case law is. But beyond being untimely, it's a boilerplate one that identifies every possible purpose that Spriegel evidence can be noticed. And the case law says that.
There's some authority, excuse me, counsel, is there some authority that provides that state has to provide more notice than it gave? And then what's the threshold there?
Yes, the state must provide notice of the specific purpose for which it seeks to introduce evidence, that it can't just sorry.
And what does that mean? What's the case law as to what that means?
I think the case law means that it must actually identify the purpose for which it seeks to introduce evidence, that it can't just throw everything out there and hope to glom on or hope that the district court will choose one of them and actually advance it. And the reason why I say this is a boilerplate in this case, Your Honor, is if the court looks at what the notice said and then looks at the arguments that were actually advanced by the state in this case, it's clearly they didn't try to use it for motive. They didn't try to use it to prior or lack of mistake. They didn't actually seek to introduce it for any of these purposes. Their notice was a boilerplate that threw everything against the wall and they hoped to sneak it by the goalie and to find one that would go in. So the notice was clearly deficient. It just threw everything out there. It did not actually identify what purpose that they sought to introduce the evidence. And then when given that opportunity, they identified that they sought to use it as propensity evidence. They saw that this is shows a propensity to commit sexual acts against minor children, which is exactly why bad act evidence should not be admitted.
Yeah, I don't disagree.
Right. Actually, but the district court made it very clear that it was common scheme or plan. That was the basis for it to be admitted, not as propensity evidence. So I agree with you, Mr. Hushka, that the state articulated an improper purpose. But does that matter given the fact that the district court clearly ruled that it was not admissible for that purpose?
Thank you, Your Honor. I think that goes to what the purpose is of this notice and for why it was actually admitted. Essentially, what the district court looked at this and said, no, you can't admit it for that, but you could alternatively admit it for it to be a common scheme or plan. Essentially, the district court did the state's job for it and said, no, you're wrong on that, but if you wanted to, you could introduce it for this and we'll allow you to introduce it for this. But then,
so, counsel, to that point, I mean, let's say we agree with you that the notice was the boilerplate notice was deficient. By the time the district court heard the evidence as to what the Spriegel evidence would be and issued its order saying what could and could not be used and for what purpose it could be advanced, didn't your client have enough notice at trial such that he could respond to the Spriegel evidence substantively?
The issue with that, Your Honor, is whether or not the state actually did then use the Spriegel evidence for common scheme or plan. And we respectfully aver, if the court looks at the record, that is not what the state did in this case. Again, they repeatedly elicited this this Spriegel evidence, but never once did they actually articulate to the jury what the purpose of it was. They essentially just threw it all out there without identifying any purpose. In closing argument, they never said, you know, look at these prior allegations. These show a common scheme or plan. They show that when he did this to GIS in this case, that it was, you know, part of this common scheme, that it was a grooming, that she has a veracity, anything of that nature. None of those arguments were actually made. Instead, what the state did is it repeatedly elicited this bad act evidence and just left it there for the jury to draw its own conclusions, for the jury to determine without guidance from the state or identification of a permissible purpose what it wanted to do. And likely the most likely conclusion that the jury would have brought from it, again, why bad act evidence isn't allowed in, is that they thought this is a bad person. If we have any doubt, let's punish this bad person because there's all these other bad facts that we've heard, all this bad evidence that we've heard about him. Specifically, again, the state called BF for the sole purpose of eliciting Spriegel evidence. They did not ask her any questions regarding the underlying allegations that were actually charged in this case. She was called, identified herself, you know, provided some biographical information, but then was asked solely regarding the hide and seek allegation. Again, an allegation that does not have a similar modus operandi. You know, the allegation in this case was that late at night, GIS went into appellant's room and the two of them were talking. And during that conversation, again, that the alleged digital penetration and everything else, that's not what the allegations were in any of these other circumstances that were alleged. Again,
but it was another cousin, right? Another female cousin of a similar age in a private kind of setting. So my bigger question is, I mean, the district court gave cautionary instructions along the line of those that are, you know, recognized to be proper under the case law. So I'm having a hard time understanding how there is any reversible error in that.
Thank you, Your Honor. The district court gave some cautionary instructions, but not after every instance. Again, as we outline in there and we identify in our brief, specifically after the investigator and after BF testified, the district court did not give a cautionary instruction. And we think that's particularly important as it relates to BF, because again, the sole reason why BF was called was to provide this bad act evidence. And so while there was some cautionary instructions, and the cautionary instructions were along the lines of what the case law has said, again, the cautionary instruction did not identify a permissible purpose for the bad act evidence. It said simply don't use it for this. But then that loop was never closed. It was never said, but you can use it for X, Y, or Z. And the state never said you can use it for X, Y, or Z. Instead, again, it was just left out there in a vacuum with the jury left to draw its own conclusions for what credit or what purpose it wanted to use the bad act evidence for. And so for the issue of whether or not this prejudiced defendant, Your Honor, I think you should look at the state's own words and the state's own briefs. When the state was seeking to admit this Spriegel evidence, this bad act evidence, the state identified that without the Spriegel evidence, its case was weak. Quote, in this case, there are some prior instances that I think are very necessary for the state to have in their case in order to move forward on a case such as this. End quote. That's from the motion hearing transcript on page 6 at line 15 through lines 22. So the state itself identified that this evidence, that introducing Spriegel evidence, was important to its case because otherwise it had a weak case. Indeed, as the investigator admitted during trial, this was a case that lacked any physical evidence whatsoever against appellant. And so this was simply a case of testimony. And in the state's own words, this testimony was necessary for it to move forward on a case such as this, again, to use the state's own words. And so I think that shows that this was prejudicial, that the improper admission was prejudicial in this case. Again, the lack of a total cautionary instruction, or again, a closing of the loop, explain what permissible purpose that this could be used was prejudicial in this case. And as for the second factor, as we kind of outlined that this court has outlined in the Olson opinion, although it's a non-precedential or a non-published opinion, outlined, you know, how focused on the case or how much in focus was the bad act evidence? Was it in center stage? Was it off to a wing? And in this case, it wasn't center stage, Your Honor. Again, the state didn't argue its purpose. It left it in that vacuum. But again, it also wasn't off in the wings either. Again, the state brought up this Spriegel evidence in the majority of the witnesses that it decided to call. It went in depth on the Spriegel evidence with GIS. It went in depth with the investigator, with the family friend. Again, brought BF in for the sole purpose of introducing this Spriegel evidence. So this isn't something that was a one-off aside that, you know, maybe the jury forgot about by the end of a multi-day trial. This was something that was brought up repeatedly, continually, purposefully, and intentionally by the state. And so that shows that, again, the state apparently thought it was important enough to bring up over and over again. And so I would argue that it was obviously important in the state's mind. It likely could have been important in the jury's mind. So for that reason, Your Honor, that's why I would say is there's the prejudice in this case. Again, we can obviously go back and I can talk to the court if it wishes regarding the modus operandi and the specific differences we see regarding the allegation charged in this case versus the other Spriegel evidence. As it relates to the hide and seek, it is a different victim. Again, it is a different manner. In that case, it was alleged that appellant entered the closet after BF was already there, as opposed to this case, it was the alleged victim coming to appellant. Again, there was some differentiations regarding digital penetration versus physical manipulation, which was never alleged in any of these prior bad act instances. So again, the modus operandi standard is supposed to be the closer they are, the more relevant it is. All of these cases, all of these prior bad act allegations have marked dissimilarities to the actual acts charged in this case. And so under that modus operandi, they weren't really relevant for any permissible purpose. Yet again, the state still repeatedly sought to bring them in for the unfair value. And again, like I said, if they were so important for a permissible purpose, if they were so important for a common scheme or a common plan or anything else like that, any permissible purpose, you would think that at least once during the multi-day trial, the state would have articulated what that permissible purpose was, but it never did. Never in closing arguments did it say, you've heard these allegations, therefore it's more likely that she's not fabricating in this case, or she has veracity, or that these aren't, you know, allegations out of nowhere. You heard the prior allegations as well. She's a credible witness. She's a fair witness. You never heard anything of that like that. You never heard this was part of a common scheme, that appellant has done this before, that this is what he likes to do because look at X, Y, and Z. Again, there was no argument of that nature brought up at all. The state was entirely silent on the purpose of this, leading and allowing the jury to simply put on to treat it as propensity evidence.
Mr. Hushka, does the case law require the prosecutor to explain to the jury the theory under which the Spriegel evidence is relevant and admissible?
Your Honor, I've not seen any specific requirement of an explanation, but again, I think it goes to what the actual purpose was, an evaluation of what the actual purpose was for the state in admitting it. And in the absence of that and any identification of it, I don't believe that the state could say it was using it as common scheme or plan, when again, it didn't argue common scheme or plan. That wasn't a theme, that wasn't a story or anything that it was trying to tell the jury. It goes to what the state was actually using the evidence. So, Your Honor, as I'm winding down on my principal argument, what I want to conclude with is simply highlighting the multitude of the state's errors in this case. Again, the Spriegel notice was not filed until nearly half a year after it was supposed to be filed. Once it was filed, it was boilerplate, identifying simply every possible purpose it could be. When asked to explain, the state admitted it sought to use it as propensity evidence. And then when actually it admitted it at trial, the state didn't use it for any permissible purpose. Your Honor, there was an error in this case. It prejudiced appellants. We ask that this court reverse and remand for a new trial, a fair trial.
Thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Ms. Schur, you may present argument on behalf of respondent.
Thank you. Excuse me. May it please the court and opposing counsel, and I'll apologize right away. I'm kind of losing my voice. I'm just getting over COVID. So I apologize for that if I am not entirely clear with what I'm saying. Your Honors, I would focus on just a few things.
Can you identify the party you represent?
I'm sorry. Kathleen Schur. I'm from Otter Tail County Attorney's Office. I represent the state in this matter. And Your Honor, I'll identify right away that I was the trial court prosecutor in this case as well. And I will fully admit that there were errors that the state did make in this case, particularly with the timeliness of the notice that was done in this case. That being said, I think that the district court has outlined in their order that was issued with regard to the Spriegel notice and the motions that were made by the defendant, that the notice was, in fact, did give the defense enough time to prepare, and that the purpose of that notice is to, in order that the defendant is not surprised at what's being offered by the state. As is indicated in the court's order, the acts that were proffered by the state were referenced in the corner house video of the victim. They were disclosed to counsel very, very early on in the case. And the subsequent acts that were identified were noticed to the defendant in orally on two different occasions in two different hearings. As the court may be aware in this from the district court's order, as well as the transcript in this case, the state had significant difficulty obtaining any support for the latter two disclosures based on the fact that they were not charged offenses. They were juvenile offenses in another state, specifically North Dakota, where the state had quite some difficulty obtaining the documents in that case. Come to find out, the defendant's own attorney was the one who represented him in those cases and was well aware that the state was attempting to obtain those documents and was well aware of the allegations in those cases. So I think that the notice aspect in itself is a non-issue in this case. The defense certainly had enough time to prepare. With regard to the boilerplate nature of the notice, again, I would note that I think it is a boilerplate motion. Could it have been done better? Absolutely. Does it prejudice the defendant in this case? No. It does not prejudice the defendant because, as the court has recognized, the district court was very articulate in their order in identifying the purposes in which the state could use this evidence. Now, the state identified all of those things in that boilerplate motion that it or notice that it gave to the defendant. But the district court purpose is to make sure that the evidence that's being offered is being offered for an appropriate purpose. There's been numerous orders by this court and by other district courts that have identified when the state does identify it for an improper purpose, the district court has said that, and no, you can't do this, but for other purposes, you are able to admit this evidence. That's exactly what the district court did in this order.
Ms. Schur, yes. Counsel for the appellant makes much of the fact that, you know, the state identified an improper purpose, right? Propensity, right off the bat. And that explains the state's subsequent failure to articulate to the jury a proper purpose and how they should view and treat the Spriegel evidence. How do you respond to that argument?
And Judge, I have looked into this issue, and there's absolutely no case law that I've been able to find that indicates that the state has to articulate to the jury or explain to the jury the purpose that it's admitting that evidence. In fact, there is case law that indicates, several cases, in fact, that cautions the state about referencing Spriegel incidents too much. There's specific case law that does particularly note that in closing arguments, that counsel should be very cautious when referencing Spriegel issues in their closing arguments, in that it may paint the defendant out to be a bad person. The state did not do this in this case. The state took the district court's order and its cautionary paragraph that it included in its order, cautioning the state in how they were going to use this evidence. I took that very seriously and was very careful in the closing argument and how that evidence was referenced. Now, what I did do, what the state did do, is several times talk about the victim's testimony. Listen to what the victim told you. Listen to what the victim told you about these prior incidents. Listen to what the cousin told you about this prior incident. As the district court also noted, and what the state did and end up using this evidence for, is to support the victim in this case, to support the victim's veracity and truthfulness in this case. Throughout this case leading up to trial, the defendant rested on the defense that the victim was making this up. And if the victim wasn't making this up, that she was the one that initiated the sexual contact. Now, the latter is not admissible in this case, based on this victim being under 16, and there could not be a consent defense in this case. But throughout this, including various motions that were filed by the defense, they attempted to paint the victim as someone who was making this up for her own gratification and for her own gain. As the district court noted in their order, the state is absolutely able to anticipate, I think what the court said, this well-telegraphed move and support the victim in another way to help the state's case. As the state noted, the state's case going into this trial was not the strongest case. This is a case where it's a victim against their perpetrator, a victim trying to essentially go head on head and get the jury to believe that they are the one telling the truth.
Well, although in unlike many cases of this nature, there was a witness there, right?
There was a witness. The unfortunate part with the witness is, as is elicited through the testimony, is the witness and the victim are best friends, although they're not blood related. They have a very, very close, almost cousin-like relationship. Throughout the case leading up to trial as well, it was alleged that there was this scheme between these two girls that were getting in trouble for other things. And that's why they came up with this quote unquote story. The other unfortunate thing is that this happened in the dark. The witness did not actually witness this happening, but actually testified that they felt that this was happening, that they were kind of confused at the victim's reactions to certain things that were going on. And stated after this incident happened that they knew what was going on because it all made sense after that. So while there is a witness, it's not as if they actually witnessed what was happening. It was more, I would say, a combination of things after the fact that led them to believe that what the victim was saying was the truth. And so while the state does have that support, you also go into this trial not knowing what the defendant is going to do and that if the defendant is in fact going to paint that picture. Now, in this case, there was nothing offered. That did not end up happening, but the state doesn't know that putting on their case. They're left with the disadvantage of not knowing what kind of attacks are going to come at the victim in this case. Now, I would just quickly turn. I think the very most important thing for the court to consider in this case is that there's been no real argument made as to how this has prejudiced the defendant in this case. Although the state came into this case believing that this was going to be a very much a he said, she said, it did end up being a very strong case. The testimony came out as the state hoped that it would come out. That's not always the case, as I'm sure this court is very aware in these cases. It's not always the case that you have a victim that comes out very strong, very credible, and testifies as you how you expect they're going to testify. And so after all is said and done, the state ended up with a very strong case. I think it's clear from the record in this case. And the defendant needs to show, they have the burden in this case to show that the evidence was prejudicial to them, so much so that the court should order a new trial. I don't think that the defendant has been able to articulate that in this case. And so I think that the court should deny the appeal on that basis. Now, I would just quickly like to note, as I see, I do have just a couple minutes left, what is not noted by the defendant is in this case, but what is evident in the district's court order is there were acts that the district court did not allow the state to bring in. There were actually two other acts, prior acts of the defendant, that the district court did not find to be similar enough in nature to not have that modus operandi that the district court did exclude. And I think that just goes to show that the district court did carefully weigh all of the Spriegel factors, did carefully weigh whether it was going to be something that was going to be prejudicial, more prejudicial than probative, and did exclude those other two acts. Now, the defendant made a big deal about the state going into the prior acts that were perpetrated against the victim in this case. The facts of this case are that the victim and her friend came up with a code word before they went in to see the defendant, before they went into his room. The jury has a right to know why that code word is being made. That's an unusual situation that you have two teenage girls going into their cousin's room having a code word. And I think that the district court highlights that as well in saying that the state has a right to present their whole case. They have a right to explain to the jury why the victim and her friend would have done this. And leaving it to hang out there, as the defendant suggests, that the state could have just said, well, she was preaching, there was a prior sexual act by the defendant against her. I fail to see how that is more less prejudicial to the defendant in this case than explaining the situation and why this code word was used. And so based on all of that, Judge, Your Honors, unless the court has any other questions, I would just ask the court find that the defendant has not shown that this was prejudicial enough to him for this court to overturn and issue or an order a new trial, and that the district court essentially did their job in this case. They were the gatekeeper. They made sure that the state was appropriate in what it could offer, appropriate in the reasons that the state was offering this evidence. And the court should affirm the conviction in this case and essentially affirm the very well done order of the district court in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Hushka, you will have the last word.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll try to kind of respond to things in reverse order. And the first being this alleged context argument that Ms. Scherr just advanced right now. That's a alleged justification that has been invented solely on appeal. They did not argue below that this was needed to provide context of the code word or anything else. Again, this is an after the fact ad hoc justification that the state is trying to invent to justify its admission of this Spriegel evidence. Now, it's not at issue whether or not they could provide context evidence. Again, context evidence is admissible. The question is, what the state actually sought to do? And I would direct this court in this decision of State versus Ness, a quote, district court should not simply take the prosecution's stated purposes for the admission of other acts evidence at face value. Instead, the court should follow the clear wording of Rule 404B and look at the real purpose for which the evidence is offered and ensure that the purpose is one of the permitted exceptions to the rule's general exclusion of other act evidence, end quote. Again, the state identified what its true purpose was in this case. It spilled the beans. It said it wanted to use this as propensity evidence. Now, the district court could try to put the lid back on the can and say, well, you can't use it as propensity, but you can use it for X, Y, and Z. Again, that's not the district court's job. The district court is supposed to evaluate why the state is trying to do it. The state said why it was trying to do it, and it wasn't for a permissible purpose. So whether it could use it as common scheme or plan or could use it as context evidence is not admissible. The district court was supposed to look at why the state was wanting to use it in this case, and the state told us that it was wanting to use it for an impermissible purpose in this case. This court should believe the state. This court should also believe the state when it said its case wasn't strong. Again, the state is trying to have its cake or eat its cake and have it too in this case. It's saying, well, it wasn't a strong case, but then it ended up being a strong case. So that's not prejudicial because it was a strong case. But again, if it was a strong case, then it was an error to admit propensity evidence, to admit bad faith evidence. Again, this decision in State versus Ness, Minnesota Supreme Court says that if it's a strong case, if the witness is credible, it's an error to admit bad act evidence. And so again, if the state is hoisting itself on its own petard saying we had a strong case, well, if you had a strong case, you didn't need to put in the bad act evidence. Instead, the court should believe. Yes, Your Honor.
You're saying exactly what I'm thinking after I've listened to these arguments. I believe at one point, the case law said the district court should wait until the state has presented its case before making a decision regarding the need. But didn't courts then back away from that, or is that still the rule, and how does it apply here?
Your Honor, I believe that came from Ness. I believe it said the best practice is to wait until trial and to see how it's come in and what the case is at the time. So obviously it wasn't the best practices. I know the courts have been, I think, a bit over the board on how they've done it after the fact. I don't think there's a clear rule on that you have to wait for trial or not. Obviously,
in this case, was an argument made to the judge that the judge should not decide the issue until hearing the state's case?
Your Honor, again, I was not counsel at trial or during the trial, but my understanding it was argued that there was not a proper purpose identified, and to the extent that it was, the state identified an improper purpose. And so again, the district court should take the state at its own word and not let it try to put in propensity evidence. And then from there, it was the district court essentially, again, doing the state's job for it. And so, again, Your Honor, this is the state trying to eat its cake and have it too. It's arguing it's a strong case and for some purposes, but a weak case forever. It's arguing that, well, we could have done it for X, Y, and Z, but there's no evidence that they actually did do it for X, Y, and Z. Again, what's at issue before this court is not whether or not the state could have put this in for some permissible purpose. What's at issue is whether or not the state actually did this in case, whether it actually identified a proper purpose, and whether it actually used it for that proper purpose. Simply stated, Your Honor, the record before this court shows the state did not seek to use Spriegel evidence for proper purpose. And despite lacking any proper purpose, actual proper purpose for that evidence, the state repeatedly and purposefully elicited Spriegel evidence, identifying and calling some witnesses for that sole purpose. Again, Your Honor, prejudice doesn't require that we have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that this would have resulted in something different. We just have to show that there is a reasonable probability that the wrongfully admissible evidence affected the verdict. Your Honor, when the state repeatedly chooses to elicit evidence, repeatedly calls attention to evidence that it doesn't have a proper purpose for, you know, I would respectfully submit that that shows at least a reasonable probability that that evidence mattered to the jury, because it mattered to the state in deciding to repeatedly show it and repeatedly elicit it. Unless there are any further questions from the court, I would yield.
Does not appear there are additional questions. Thank you, Mr. Hushka. Thank you, Ms. Shore. We appreciate your arguments this morning. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.